young, I'd listen to the radio.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
Bob Trout speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is Mutual.
This is ABC Radio Network.
And hello and welcome to Same Time, Same Station with your hosts, Larry and John Gassman. And on this week's show, we'll be playing radio shows, but they're more of a contemporary nature. And the interview that we have scheduled is with two people who were very much involved in producing, writing, directing, and starring in a radio show, and engineering a radio show that was on for 7 years back in the 1970s. And it was an interview show.
It was really ahead of its time. There weren't too many on before them interviewing the old-time radio people.
Jim Harmon did it for a while, and Chuck Shaden. And we're talking 1970 now. And also, Tom Heathwood as well, among others. And I'm missing some people, I know that. And then later, Bob and Barbara, Bob Lyons out here, and we were involved later as well. But in 1970, and I won't get too much into this because the interview will take part of what we were going to say, but WTIC embarked on a radio show. And you can read all about it. You can go to the webpage. You can download all the shows. And Dick Bertel and Ed Corcoran actually began the process of interviewing radio personalities. Bob Schirego engineered.
You could collect these back in the 70s, but they were air checks and not in very good sound quality.
Oh, I remember getting shows and the sound was horrible.
Yeah. But luckily, those tapes have been preserved. They had almost all of them, and the things that were missing they got from some collector. So everything is now in pristine sound, just great sound for the most part.
We interviewed Dick and also Bob Schirego for about 50 minutes. We played a couple of excerpts. But before we go to the interview, let me give you a webpage to explore. This is the webpage. It's www.goldenage-wtic.org. And you'll see bios on the people that we're about to interview, plus you'll see several shows that they did that you can download, including some from the big bands. And we'll be talking more about that show later on. Anyway, once again, www.goldenage-wtic.org. Now let's chat with Dick Bertel and Bob Schirego.
Joining us today on Same Time, Same Station are two individuals who go really about as far back as you can go in terms of the modern days of interviewing the old-time radio personalities. Back in the 1970s, there was a station, and still is actually, called WTIC. And one of the individuals who was on that particular show every week is with us today, Dick Bertel, and the engineer, Bob Schirego. And gentlemen, thank you and welcome to Same Time, Same Station. And we want to talk a lot about how that show got started, because it was really one of the pioneering shows insofar as interviewing old-time radio people are concerned.
I'm sure you're right, yeah. We went back actually to the mid-1960s before the Golden Age of Radio series got started. So we really were pioneers.
And how did it start?
Well, a man by the name of Ed Corcoran, who appears on all of the Golden Age shows, called me one day. I had a talk program on in the afternoon, and he said, you know, I collect old-time radio programs, and I'm wondering if you would be interested in playing some of them. Well, I was more interested in talking with him as a collector. I thought that might be an interesting interview for me. So I invited him down to the radio station. He came down with some cassette tapes, as I recall, and some 16-inch original discs, which I played on a studio turntable. And I was hooked. I mean, I had grown up with this kind of radio, but I hadn't heard it in 20 years at that point. So I invited him to appear on I wouldn't say a regular basis, but every once in a while, Ed would come on and do a bit with me. And that continued for about 5 years or so. We created a program at Christmas time in 1966 or 67 called Echoes of Christmas Past. and we would use some of the Christmas stories that were on the air during the Golden Age and build a, you know, a conversation around those. So it worked out well. By about 1970 or so, I thought, you know, we could do a monthly series on this subject, and that's how it got started.
And when you started, did you have any idea as to how you would prepare from month to month? Because I assume radio contacts weren't plentiful. How did you get in touch with the people?
That's a good question. Ed had a lot to do with our contacts. There's no question about it. And I'm not quite clear as to how he was able to find out where people were or lived. It was a long time ago. It was 40 years ago. But what happens is when you interview one person, they'll tell you, well, you know, so-and-so lives down in Cheshire, Connecticut,
and he'd
be good for your program. Mm-hmm. And so one interview begins to lead into another. And I would think that, you know, the majority of our interviews came about in that fashion. We did find out about, you know, well-known people, people who had been stars in the business, and we contacted them, and they said, yes, we'd be happy to do an interview. But usually we had to go on location for that. So,
yeah,
another great resource, I think, was the local summer theater. There were a lot of old radio people who were starring in summer productions, and Dick would find out about those, or Ed would find out about those and contact them. And I remember once we interviewed Hans Conried, as a matter of fact, sitting on the stage of a summer theater. Right on the set where they were going to do the play in the evening. I'm sure you remember that one, Dick.
Absolutely, yeah. We were part of the set.
Right.
Bob is absolutely right. And I'll tell you something else that drove the program. It was sponsored almost from the beginning by local advertisers. And so it became necessary. We were required to come up with a new show every month. And that caused us to, you know, look around and make sure that we were able to find people.
Was the show actually done live, or did you pre-record it in most cases?
We thought at first that we would do the show live, and in fact, the first three shows were live for one reason or another. I thought that would be rather exciting. But then it soon became apparent that if we were going to get the people we wanted to get, we had to get them on their own time, and so we started recording.
And recording, of course, in those days was quite a bit more involved than it is today, where you can move a digital recorder and you take it even in your pocket, you know, and just carry it around. But in those days, of course, you had the open reel recorders, I would imagine, Bob, and carrying those things from one location to another.
I remember doing that.
It was probably rather interesting.
Oh, absolutely. Most of the recordings on location were done with engineers. I wasn't the only one who did them. Whoever happened to be available for a recording would be assigned to do it. And we would go out with a portable recorder and a couple of microphones and set up in a person's home, office, or in some cases, studio. We recorded High Brown in the radio studio for the CBS Radio Mystery Theater, which was actually a converted television studio, which was kind of revolutionary since so many of the TV studios were converted radio studios. So we would go out on location and record with the archaic reel-to-reel tape machines. On occasion, Dick would be able to get one on his portable machine by himself. If it was a strange hour or a place that was inconvenient for an engineer to go along.
What about Ed?
It was required that we have good quality, good broadcast quality, because we had to fill an hour. Mm-hmm. We couldn't have, you know, a portable sound to it. It had to have full dynamic range.
What about when Ed would go to Hollywood or something like that and do something where you guys weren't in proximity? What did he do in terms of recording?
Interesting. Yeah. Ed managed to find professional engineers who were also radio enthusiasts who actually recorded his interviews for him. And that's why the quality is so good. You know, we have Edgar Bergen and Mel Blanc and Elliot Lewis and people like that. and they were all professionally recorded.
Boy, how fortunate. Because
and I remember the one, there was one where you had four or five people, including Les Tremaine, gathered around a table at a Pacific Pioneers, I guess it was a Sportsman's Lodge, after a meeting.
Yeah, but they already had their equipment there because they recorded the meeting, so you had professional equipment
That's
there
true,
in
yeah.
the house.
Yeah.
So that worked out easily.
I want to get to my webpage here and see what show you're talking about, but I do remember that, yeah. And again, that was Ed's work.
So everything was it 7.5 or 15 IPS, do you think?
Oh, 7.5.
Oh, I can't. I would think 7.5. That was certainly adequate, yeah.
We did everything at 7.5.
Mm-hmm.
That particular show went on in March of 1975, and it was with Les Tremaine, Buddy Lou Gerson, Brett Morrison, and Vincent Pelletier, who were from the early Chicago radio days.
Right.
And that was recorded in L.A.
So for the most part, the quality was excellent. We lucked out. A few of the shows were recorded using portable equipment or home recording equipment, but not very many.
For an hour-long show that includes commercials, etc., how much actual recording did you have to do to make sure you feel? Did you go over an hour purposely?
No. In many cases, we felt if we could get 20 minutes out of them, we had a show. The reason I say that is because people would come to the studio, as Bob indicated earlier, let's say from a dinner theater. They would come to do a publicity interview, we would ask them to stay and talk a little bit about radio. And in many cases, they would say, well, okay, I'll give you 15 minutes. Well, 15 minutes we would drag into 20, 25, and that was enough to do a show, including the excerpts from their programs.
Talk about memorable people that you still remember today for whatever reason when doing that show.
First of all, I've got to tell you, they were all my heroes. I had grown up with these people, and to meet them and talk with them on a somewhat equal basis, because, I was now a professional myself, was a real thrill. And one of the first people we interviewed of that ilk, of that caliber for me, was Jackie Kelk. And Jackie, of course, had been with the Aldrich family for many, many years. He played the part of Homer. And, I was just thrilled beyond belief that this person was in my studio talking to me and treating me as an equal, which I appreciated so much.
One of the shows I vividly remember, actually, well, hearing it when it first came on, which was during my early collecting days, was the interview that you guys did with Hamilton O'Hara. And then hearing it in such great sound quality a few months ago brought back a lot of memories. And it was just a terrific show because you could tell he just loved what he was doing and loved showing the sound effects to you.
Oh, he did. That was a fun interview to do. And we did it, of course, at his home. But he had all of these sound effects devices set up so that he could actually do them for us.
And he had the turntables. He could take you step by step through a program.
I can't remember.
When he retired.
You could. And remember, I think we did Grand Central Station. I did the opening announcements.
There's one man at a console. He's got four records. Give you an idea of the sequence here, because it is not one sound sequence on one record. There's four records involved here, as I say. Now, here's the opening. The very first sound, if you remember, is the train approaching. Remember that one?
I sure do.
Okay, now it passes us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now we go to the interior, and this is the passenger train running. This is going to go behind your announcement.
Right.
Right? We're running. Right. Just going down the tracks, coming down the Hudson, right? And now we come to the part where the script says, and dives with a roar under the tunnel under Park Avenue. This is a third record. Right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a heavier sound, right? And then we have at the very end, this is a record of continuous steam. Okay? This runs continuously. And I'm going to have the volume control wide open, and I have a switch here, and I'm going to switch it in. and fade it out, see?
And I've just got to remember when to come in with the announcements.
Okay.
What always amazed me was that there never were any steam trains going into Grand Central Station in modern times, at any rate.
Author's license.
Right.
Yes.
But,
it's like the rugs on the floor, right?
Sure. Okay.
Yeah.
You all set?
All set.
Here we go.
I start this thing off with the train.
As a bullet seeks its target, shining rails in every part of our great country are aimed at Grand Central Station, heart of the nation's greatest city. Drawn by the magnetic force of the fantastic metropolis, day and night, great trains rush toward the Hudson River, sweep down its eastern bank for 140 miles, flashed briefly by the long red row of tenement houses south of 125th Street, dive with a roar into the 2.5-mile tunnel which burrows beneath the glitter and swank of Park Avenue, and then... Grand Central Station, crossroads of a million private lives, gigantic stage on which are played 1,000 dramas daily.
Oh, wow, that was great fun.
How did we do that? Yeah, that's a busy one.
Oh, yeah, that's the way it was done, though.
That's right.
You know, and that was really fun to do.
And Gangbusters.
Gangbusters, okay, yeah, with the marching men, the marching... a guard, so to speak.
What you have here is a wooden frame.
Right, it's like
a
picture
frame. And some wooden
frame.
Blocks, right, suspended by cord.
Right. And these are to simulate, well, should I not tip them off? Why don't we just do it first and see? And see if you can tell me what show it's from, too.
All
the,
right.
Or the show that's most connected with this sound.
Gangbusters.
Yeah. Now you put a little echo on there, you know, and it really, you know, builds up in body, you know, and put a siren with that. Why don't we do that Gangbusters opening?
You're a wild man.
Work on that. Why don't you do it? You and Ed, right? Play announcer. And I'll play sound effects man.
Now, Ed, you're going to do the marching feet.
Yes, Dick. I'm all poised and ready to go here.
Okay. And, Ham, you're over at a series of turntables to get the rest of the effects.
I got the machine gun over here on a record. I have the siren over here. And in my mouth, I'm going to have a police whistle.
All right. And I'll be the voice. Here we go. Calling the police, calling the G-men, calling all Americans to war on the underworld. Gangbusters! Hey, you're hired. Okay.
Well, that sounded very real.
It did. It did, as a matter of fact. The
incidentally, I might mention that the records we're using here this afternoon are the actual original authentic records. They're the old 78s. I don't know whether anybody's... out there seen an actual sound effects record, but they may have bought some of the LPs that are on the market of sounds. We found them rather useless, the LPs, because of physical problems. The micro groove in an LP is very difficult to see into, and we have to see into that groove in order to work very fast at a console. I might show you how that works while we are on the subject. All right. Here's Big Ben thing. Okay, we're going to use this in a minute when we simulate the opening of Bulldog Grumman.
All right.
All right. Now, we're down in the middle of the record. We're not at the beginning. We're way down in the middle, and here's the bell. Here's the bell tolling, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, we want to start right at the first bell. Okay. It's going through its whoopee thing about dum 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 dum, you know. Now
right.
It comes down to the striking. Now there's the bell. Eh? I'm backing the record up about a half a turn before that, and the needle is still sitting in that groove. Eh? Now, I take a piece of chalk, and I chalk the grooves right ahead of the needle. Eh? Now I back the needle through the chalk, and you notice there's a little empty groove. Empty black groove there showing in the through the chalk, right? Now the reason for that is that I have pre-prepared the record for the show. Okay? Now I can take the record off and put it up here. And when I come to that effect later on in the show, I can just set that needle right down in that groove without having to hunt for that bell. And that's how we work fast, you see.
Do you know that you've just taken me back 20 years? I hadn't thought of that since I studied, and we studied, you know, all aspects of radio production when I went to college, and we studied sound effects. But I hadn't thought of that chalk cueing in 20 years.
So, you know, just to see if my hand is still good, now I'm putting the record back on the turntable,
it
right?
It doesn't disturb the fidelity when you do that, when it goes over the chalk on the next turn.
That's right. And, well, we're not dealing with the high-fidelity records to begin with. You know, these are old 78s. Now, I'm going to just slip this needle right down in the groove. Now, you can hear me. I'm going to flick the needle. Right? I'm going to set it right down in that groove. All right, now we let it go. Okay, we got the bell. Right? Now, I didn't have to hunt for it.
And how many records might you be juggling during the course of a half-hour show?
I've had up to 50, 60 records or more.
These stories I've never heard, Ham. You had a copy of the script on the top of the console, did you, behind your turntables?
There's a rack here for the records. It's for stacking records and stacking script.
I'm trying to remember if you guys actually were patched into the turntables. I don't remember.
Oh, yes, we were. Oh, yes. Yes, we were patched in. It wasn't an acoustical pickup at all. No, we were. No, the whole thing was recorded directly into our equipment.
When he retired from CBS, he somehow managed to get an entire sound effects board with all the equipment with it and install it in his basement. He took it from CBS or bought it or was given it. I'm not sure how that worked out. And so he had everything that you could possibly imagine for sound effects. As I recall, I don't think we used any excerpts in that show. I think the whole thing was done live in his basement.
Yeah.
Another show that we did in the same way was at Rosario's home. She was the organist who was on so many soap operas. She was out of New York. And she had a Hammond organ in her home, and she played for us, and she was interviewed, and there were no excerpts in that show either. The entire show was Rosa playing radio and playing the organ and her piano. And I'm sure you know that she just died this year at age 107.
Isn't that amazing?
And she was still really playing the organ in Tampa, Florida.
You know, one of the things that you may not understand, and I think it's important that we bring it out, is the fact that we had no idea who owned or had rights to these radio programs that Ed was playing on the air. And that's why you never hear a complete show, or very rarely hear a complete show, on our program. We felt that if we played 5 or 6 minutes of something, we couldn't get sued.
Well, that's true.
And,
yeah.
And so I'll give you another example. One of the Echoes of Christmas Past Christmas shows that Ed and I did, and which is available on our website, by the way, includes a letter that I received from Bristol Myers giving me permission to run the Santa Claus routine that Fred Allen used to do every year, Santa Claus Rides Tonight or whatever the name of it was. And they gave me the permission, and I read that on the air, and only later did I realize that the excerpt that we had used was from a Texaco program. So, you know, nobody
really cared.
No,
just the fact that you were able to get the show and air it was exciting. Who cared where it came from?
Yeah, we've all run into the problems with people trying to say, well, you can play this and you can't play this. We ran into that with one of the guys who used to syndicate a lot of the shows. And later,
It was Charlie Michelson.
It was Charlie Michelson. And later on, he found out that we had some stuff that he needed, so we ended up sharing stuff with him. And then we never had any problems with him afterward. We just say, can we play this? And he said, sure.
Well, that was one of the factors that governed our program, and it was real. I mean, we didn't want to get into trouble, you know, and when I say we, I'm talking about the radio station. So, you know,
you kept the sponsor for a long, long time, you got the sponsor and you began to play shows. Did the show grow in terms of popularity over the years as well?
Well, from a from an audience standpoint, I really can't answer that. You know, the program aired at 9 o'clock on some weeknight. You know, and you know the competition from television was so strong that I can't imagine that we had a major audience. It was a hardcore audience that followed the program and, you know, corresponded with us and kept us motivated. The thing that kept us motivated most of all was the fact that we had a sponsor. And that's why you'll see, if you look at the list of programs, you'll see guests who were only on the periphery of radio. I'm looking at Joan Fontaine, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, she did radio programs like Lux and so on. And she was more than delighted and happy to work with us and talk to us about her radio experience. But she wasn't really a radio actress, as you know. She was a movie star. So we needed somebody that week or that month. That's what I'm trying to say.
Mm-hmm. And how far in advance would you start working on people for the next show?
Well, I would say we certainly try to keep, you know, 1 month ahead. In other words, if we were trying to build a January show, we would be working on it in October or November, making the contact at least, you know, and getting something lined up. And sometimes, as in the case of, I'm going to single out Joan again, we didn't have anybody, and we just needed somebody to do that show. So that's how it worked, and what was amazing was that Ed was able, as a computer salesman, to make himself readily available when these people came into the studio. He was able to get down there. I can't recall the specifics of how he did that, but he managed, and so we were able to do the show together.
Is there anybody that you never got that you had been working on and just it never worked out, or maybe they didn't want to do it?
Well, I can't recall offhand. I do recall Ginger Rogers being at the radio station. Ed was there. And we tried to corral her into doing the interview, and she said no. Just that, no. So she evidently was all business. She didn't want to do anything that took up her time other than the interview she was there for to publicize her appearance.
There are several interviews on the website that never aired. Is that because the show went off the air? And if so, why did the show eventually go off the air?
Went off the air because I resigned from WTIC.
Oh, that's a good
reason.
I went
to work for the Voice of America. Let me talk about the extra shows. When we decided to put the, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, Bob, but when we decided to put the website together, there were shows that were missing. We had gaps, perhaps 7, 8, 9 shows that just didn't exist as far as we were concerned. And I wanted to fill those gaps. I just thought that chronologically it might be a good idea to keep everything in place and without changing dates and so on. So let's put a show in that slot that didn't actually broadcast. And then we found all the shows through collectors. So we were able to put the shows together chronologically and wound up with some extra shows that never really aired, but I thought should be on there because they were of value. So
the extra shows were made up from interviews that Dick had that were outside of the realm of the Golden Age broadcasts, and it worked out very nicely. When we first started doing this on the internet site, we didn't have nearly as much bandwidth as we do now, so we were putting up one or two shows a week, and it would require me to upload a show, promote it, and then replace it with another one the following week or 2 weeks later. Then we were able to get a website that or a server that had a lot more space on it, and that's how we were able to put all of the shows on at one time.
We haven't talked at any length about post-production on the programs. Bob, as he indicated, was the engineer on many of the shows. He was the field engineer, as were other engineers from WTIC. But usually the task of post-production fell into Bob's lap, and that was to edit the tapes and include the excerpts and so on. So You might want to talk a little bit about that, Bob.
One of the interesting things was that at the beginning of each of the early shows, Dick would introduce Ed Corcoran as the man who has 2,000 hours of radio programs on tape, which, of course, in those days was a huge collection, and now it's a very small collection by collector's standards. But Ed would bring in tapes, and a lot of them were not really good quality to begin with, and so I would have to do a lot of equalization, a lot of balancing of levels to make it sound almost broadcast worthy. Then Dick would decide how much of the show was going to be used, and we would go ahead and edit a copy of it to fit in the time frame that we needed. And we'd usually have about 3 excerpts per show. And so Dick and Ed would do an introduction to the excerpt, and then, of course, it would be my task to edit it into the show. So we had 3 different source materials: the excerpts, the interview between Dick and Ed, and then the interview with the radio personality.
And then you'd have to leave room for commercials, too.
That's right. And the commercials, yeah, of course. And then we had to add the music and the opening and the closing and whatever else we needed to add to make a complete show. One of the driving forces, of course, was our producer, the producer who did most of the shows, at least until 1974, and that was Brian Hartnett. And Brian would basically take the radio shows, listen to them, tried to put them in some kind of order so that they made sense. He might take a 30-minute drama and boil it down to 12 minutes and have a beginning, a middle, and an end to it, so it almost seemed like a complete show. He did a really nice job on that.
So Ed didn't bring in excerpts. He would just bring in the shows, and you guys would edit them down into excerpt form?
That's correct.
Oh, okay. I just assumed he brought in excerpts.
No, he brought in raw tapes, and sometimes it was a very interesting job to find what we needed from the tapes, because some of them might have many different shows on each tape, and we had to find the right one.
Ed, as an amateur, he was not a professional broadcaster, neglected to label tapes very clearly, and so that was a problem, too. And that's not a criticism, that's just the way we operate when we're not broadcasters. But, we needed information in a hurry, and so sometimes it was difficult to find these tapes or find what we were trying to look for, that sort of thing. So that was a problem.
Yeah, and we come across that a lot with people, especially who donated tapes to organizations that we belonged to in the past. Sometimes they were really good about giving you everything you needed and more. Other times you'd be lucky to get the name of the show, and then you'd have to figure out or go hunt to find dates and other pieces of information that were needed, especially sure. When we would broadcast stuff as well. So I can imagine exactly what you're talking about.
Well, and today things are so well chronicled in terms of logs and information that all you really have to do is know where to go to find it. But it's a lot easier today than it was back in the 70s.
And in those early days of radio collecting, since Ed's collection was extensive by those standards, by that day's standards, but not by today's standards, the guest might have been someone where Ed had no recordings at all of that particular person, but he might have something that was related to a show that was mentioned by the guest. And so you might not actually hear the program referred to in the interview, but you would hear something similar. And that's why that was, because Ed did not have a complete collection, and he probably would today if he were still collecting, if he is still collecting.
When he did his remotes, would he have a checklist of things he needed to accomplish while he was chatting with a person? And would it be the same as what you guys were doing locally?
I have no knowledge or information on that whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
What absolutely amazed me was the quality of the interview. I'm not talking technically. I'm talking about the quality that Ed put into the interviews when he was talking to people like Edgar Bergen, mm-hmm, and Mel Blanc, mm-hmm, and so on. I don't know whether they were planned in advance, or if he just did them as by the seat of his pants, yeah, so to speak. But they were well done.
The reason I ask that is because as a broadcaster, I know what I want to accomplish when I go to somebody's house.
Sure.
Because I know what needs to be done in order for it to be a good show. He, by his own admission, was not a broadcaster. And so I was just curious as to how those kinds of remotes actually worked out before you actually got the tapes to make them airable and usable.
Ed would tell us, especially at first, that he was headed to California and he was going to try to get some interviews. And I said, well, fine. I didn't take him very seriously because I was afraid that what he might come back with would be some sort of a portable cassette recording that would not be usable on the air. And when he came back with the material that he had, I was really blown away and very pleased.
I think a big part of the reason that Ed was able to get such good interviews by himself was that he was so interested in the subject that he asked the same questions that any of the interested listeners would have asked. He wanted to know, so he asked those questions, and they would have been the same questions that any collector would have wanted to ask. He did it very well.
And looking back at it in retrospect now, your show, one of the reasons it's so important today to a lot of us who have done these interviews since the 70s is that you had a chance to get to people that we didn't get to. Maybe they passed away, or maybe they just became not able to do that anymore after you interviewed them. So you got a lot of, I mean, we all got a lot of the same people, but you got people that never did any other interviews, and that's why it's such an important show.
That's interesting to hear. Can you name somebody that we have almost exclusively? I'm curious.
Mary Jane Higby was one who, of course, wrote the book about that time, Tune In Tomorrow, and she had done a few interviews, but she was back east and hadn't done that many, so she's one, most definitely, that we never got to. And it was fun to listen to her talk about her radio days.
I would guess that Peg Lynch might have been another.
Well, Peg Lynch, actually, we got Peg Lynch at the Friends of Old Time Radio Convention.
That's right. She was at convention.
She was at,
right?
Yeah. But,
and then she came out here.
And she came out here. We brought her out here for the Spurdvet conventions on a couple of occasions.
In fact, she just turned 94 here a couple days ago.
What? Oh, isn't that marvelous? That's wonderful.
And I mean, she is still with it. She is incredibly sharp.
John Gibson and William Spear,
we never got. Of course, Bill Spear is very well known out here, and a lot of people talked about him. But you may have gotten him on the only radio-related interview that I am aware of.
And I think Bill passed away not too long after that interview was recorded.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I know he passed away in the 70s. Rudy Valley we got. And there are all kinds of stories about Rudy Valley that we'd heard prior to actually having him. One of which, Marvin Miller told the story. I have no idea whether it's true or not, but it's a good story. And in that Rudy had a phone booth at his house, and if you wanted to make a phone call, you'd have to use the phone booth. And I have no idea whether that's true, but the image that conjures up is fascinating.
Of course. They did depict him on his radio shows as being cheap.
Yes, they did.
Along the lines of Jack Benny, and
right.
I remember that very clearly.
Yeah.
The story that comes to mind is during 1943, I actually heard this program on the air. A young boy delivers a telegram to him, and he says, "Oh, you probably want a tip." And the boy says, "Yes." And he says, "Well, here is a nice dime for you." And the boy says, Oh, it's a new penny. Well, of course, in 1943, the pennies were white, and that was the joke. And so, that's the way he was depicted. Maybe the telephone booth is apocryphal. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's a good story nonetheless.
It is.
There's somebody else you had on, and I'm trying to think of her name, and she played the witch in The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, my gosh, you're talking about Margaret Hamilton.
Margaret Hamilton, and we never got her. I did see her at Pacific Pioneer Broadcasters luncheons from time to time, but she never did an interview out here. And when I saw that, I thought, wow, that's great that they got her.
Prior to recording that radio show, I had her in the television studio doing a half-hour interview with me on camera. And one of the recollections of that interview that I have is that when I asked you how did they do that that scene where you actually melt and go into the floor, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and she said, "Well, little boy, I'll tell you." And I thought that was really sweet. So.
John Gibson was another one that we didn't get, and of course we've heard his voice many, many, many times, both in New York and in Hollywood. But how did you wind up getting him? Is that somebody Ed got?
It might very well have been. Mm-hmm. Many of these people had written books and were going through on book tours. Carroll,
okay, yeah, right.
Who was a writer for the Kraft Music Hall, mm-hmm. among other shows, was one of those people. But I cannot remember how we got John. It, mm-hmm. I think it probably was through Ed.
Because you also got some people that we never, actually I never heard of before, who were, no. you know, people that worked in radio, but were more on the technical end. And I think that's a great thing to have done. You covered just about every aspect of radio.
We did. And I know that you're thinking of an engineer who appeared on the program twice. I'm trying to come up with his name now as I go down this list here.
It's a name that is not easily pronounceable, if I remember correctly.
Right.
Gisalbert was his last name, right?
Yes, I think you're right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I've got it. Aldo Gisalbert. The remarkable thing about that interview, from my standpoint, is his description of the NBC studios back there in the early 30s, mm-hmm. of the excitement of moving over to Radio City. My God, where are you going to get the information like that today?
You're
know?
Not.
And he had it all for us. So I think that's probably one of the more valuable interviews in the whole collection.
Dick, there's somebody that you guys got that we didn't get, and he started here and wound up in New York, and he was a wonderful character actor, and I would love to have had the chance to have talked to Leon Janney.
There certainly was a distinction, and perhaps a bit of discrimination, as you pointed out, between daytime and nighttime shows. It was more prestigious to appear on nighttime radio.
Oh, yes, it was. Now, mm-hmm. for instance, one of the most prestigious that I used to do regularly, there were about, I would say, anywhere from 6 to 10 of us that played the villains on this one particular show. And it was considered the plum, practically, of all, and that was Mr. District Attorney. Now, that, of course, was a nighttime show with Jay Johnston. As a matter of fact, I must admit that after having been on the show for about 5 years, Jay sort of looked upon himself as the district attorney. And for at least 2 years after the show went off the air, he sort of walked around with the air of somebody that had been defeated for re-election. But I guess, actually, I mean, daytime or nighttime shows, practically every show that originated in New York over the period of, we'll say, from 1945 to 1954, I think practically every one I was on at one time or another. I remember at one point, there was 1 week that I did 50 shows.
50 shows.
I was doing 5 soap operas and averaging about 4 of those. That's 20. And 3 of them had live repeats. That made 32. I did the Ford Theater, which was an hour show and took 2 days to rehearse in itself. So I had conflicts. I had stand-ins for rehearsal crossing themselves in the hall. And then during the weekend, I did 10 or 15 recordings of Editor's Daughter, and then I did another one called The Life of Mary Southern that I used to record.
You mentioned the term stand-in, Leon. Now, this was an actor who would read your lines for you while
That's
you
right.
were on another show.
That's right, because you see, you got paid so much an hour for rehearsal and then so much for the show. Well, in the early days, it used to be that I would get a conflict. We'll say the rehearsal for a show was 1 to 3, and the show went on at 3 o'clock. I would say to the director, unfortunately, I don't finish working. I can't get there till 2 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he'd say, well, I guess I can work around that, all right. So, okay, you come at 2 o'clock. Now, the cast would be there at 1, and he would turn and say, oh, Ed, will you, you're not in that scene. Will you read Leon's lines in this? Well, that was unfair because I was being paid that extra hour's rehearsal. So the union itself passed the rule that no one was allowed to read for anybody else. So and then I would have to hire somebody, which was only right, and then I would pay him the full amount that I got for that rehearsal hour. Now, although that was not a tremendous amount of money, it helped pay the rent of a lot of actors, and also it gave them an opportunity to be heard by a director that they may never have a chance to audition for or anything. I must tell you a very funny one that happened once. For all of the one show that I adored was the entire time that Charlie Chan was on radio, I played Number One Son. Well, there were only two Charlie Chans. The first was Ed Begley, and the second is Santos Ortega. So one day, Ed, there's another actor, I don't know if you know him, Ralph Camargo. He's also an actor-announcer. Right. Well, Ralph and I were going to a party this night, so I said, meet me at the studio. And Ed was due back for the repeat broadcast. We went on at 8:15, and we had a repeat broadcast at 11:15. So here is Santos Ortega sitting in the control room, and we're sitting and talking, waiting for the repeat, and suddenly look up, and the clock says 11:14, and there's no Ed Begley. Now, we knew he had a job in between, but he was going to be back. Well, it turned out somebody had lied to him about the time. Big joke. Well, suddenly, we're a minute from being on the air. Ed's script is in the control room, and the director, Alfred Bester, hands it to Ralph Camargo and says, you're Charlie Chan. So he goes, yes, and like a fire horse, he goes out in the studio, and he hasn't even had a chance to read the script or anything, and the first thing you know is something like, Charlie Chan bid you good evening and warm welcome, and he say, you know, and then comes a little homily, and that opens the show. Well, he did it and did it very well, and then comes the commercial. And while the commercial is going on, Camargo turns to me and says, I don't do Chinese.
Good story. You mentioned something earlier, Leon, which intrigues me. You said that you were sitting over in the corner reading the newspaper because you didn't come on until page 5. What was the actor's life like in the studio when a radio program was on the air?
It absolutely amazed anybody that watched, because here we would be doing highly dramatic shows or something, but if you were off for 3 or 4 pages, you'd sit down and read the sports section or something else. You were completely out of it because nobody was watching you. It wasn't television or anything. And then you'd sort of remember a warning that there was a music cue or something. Well, of course, every once in a while, you might get so intrigued in that paper that you'd miss the music cue and somebody would then begin waving wildly and you'd dash for that microphone and maybe be a few seconds late. But you got a dressing down for that. You know, I've really felt, I'd almost like to say this, and I think it's important to say, that in this country of 200 million people, there has to be somewhere between 10 and 20 million, including the blind and ones psychologically unattuned, and others that whose imagination television does not give full vent to, that would appreciate radio drama, good radio drama, not bringing back, I don't, like, for instance, these things we've heard today, they belong in their era. That's and right. They're sort of fun. They're like revivals of old movies, you know, that you see, that you enjoy, as revivals and so on. But there is a place for modern drama on radio, and I wish that people would write in and say, we would like to hear good radio drama, and perhaps we could bring back maybe even one program to start with that might go on once a week. But I believe there would be a good response to it.
Well, can radio do it, do you feel, as effectively as television?
Yes, I do, and I think they can do straight dramas just as well. But one field that this may titillate your audience a bit is there are many, there's millions of them, including myself, science fiction addicts. Now, the sets and so on are just prohibitive. You can't put that on television. And then what happens is they do manage to do something, it's not the way you feel it should be.
We were not thinking in terms of the historic importance of these programs. We were thinking in terms of filling an hour because the local bank required that we do that, you know, as the sponsor.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, no, we had no idea that they would be preserved or thought of as historical. In fact, they are, and I'm very proud of that.
What kind of reaction are you getting now from people who find it via the website versus listening when they were originally broadcasts?
Well, unfortunately, we don't get as much reaction as we'd like to. We get an occasional email saying, loved your show. But I wouldn't say that we get a lot of feedback from listeners. We might have 150 hits a week,
mm-hmm.
which I think is not bad. Sometimes it's more than that. On occasion, I'll try to promote it on the Golden Age list,
the old-time radio
and
digest
when that
list,
happens,
yeah.
Right. And when that happens, we get more. There was
mm-hmm.
1 week, in fact, that we got 300
wow.
a few months ago. But we are getting a lot more listeners to this than we ever did on when it was run live on the radio.
And I assume that you probably heard from people who were collectors who sent tapes to people who then sent tapes to other people who were well outside the listening range of the station when it was originally done.
correct. That's correct. And I was amazed by that, that there were actually recordings of our program being circulated among collectors. I found that out, I guess, about 20 years ago or so.
Yeah, because I remember, I think we started in 70 or 71, and we got copies of shows. Who knows where we got them from? In just so-so sound. Thank God the shows exist in such crisp sound now. But it didn't matter because we got a chance to hear people we'd never heard interviewed before. And I thought it was a terrific show.
Well, that's wonderful. I really am pleased to hear you say that and to learn that your association with the program goes back as far as it does, because we didn't know. We would do the program, forget about it, literally forget about it, and go on to the next show. And I have no idea, Larry, I have no idea why we had these shows. I know we had them. I had them in my basement. I had these huge 10-inch reels, and I have no recollection of keeping them. My guess is that they were about to be thrown out, and somebody said, "Here, you want this stuff?" And I said, "Yes," but that is only speculation.
I remember that you discovered that you had those reels. You weren't even sure that you had them, and you weren't even sure that what was on all of them, and it was so fortunate that you had almost all of the shows. The other interesting thing was that we were able to get a few shows from listeners who had made copies of them, and they sent them to you.
Fortunately, there was a listener in Newington who was also an old-time radio collector, and he recorded he didn't record them all, but he recorded the shows that we didn't have.
Wow.
And
really?
So we were able to get copies of those. He sent us the original tapes that he had, and we were able to get them remastered and so on. So we were very happy about that.
I'm curious from a technical standpoint about the composition of the actual tapes that you found in your basement. Were they recorded on Ampex 456, or I can't remember whether that was later or not, but I do know that some forms of Ampex squealed tremendously back in the 70s and more likely into the 80s, and I'm wondering if you had trouble transferring that material.
We used Scotch 111.
Okay.
Almost exclusively in those days. And that held up very well.
I think it still does today. That hasn't seemed to have been a problem with that type squealing at all.
Yeah, I do remember that when we worked, when Dick and I both worked for the Voice of America, we used Ampex tape, and it wasn't really as good as the Scotch tape. And I don't mind doing a commercial because neither of them makes tape anymore.
Yeah, true. I have a question about Voice of America for the both of you. Were you working at Voice of America about the time that Bill Robeson was working for them?
I had a very short association with the Voice of America in 1977. Bill was, I believe, yes, he was working for them at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I then left the Voice, went back to Connecticut, went back to Hartford, and became the general manager of WKSS in Hartford, and returned to Washington in 1984. He was by that time retired, I'm sure.
He was retired. In fact, he was living in, I think, McLean, Virginia at the time, and we brought him out to Spurdvac in Los Angeles in 1984. And he was retired at that time. And we talked a little bit about the Voice of America, not much and not a lot about the people who were there. But I think, and I'm trying to remember who else there was somebody else we knew who worked for the Voice of America about that time. But it was 84 when we brought him out. And he had just retired not long prior to that.
Bill Robeson's interview is a total mystery to me because I never did the interview. Although you'll hear my voice on it, but I never did the interview. what we did was to override some of Ed Corcoran's questions so that I could be inserted into the program.
I thought that's what happened.
Could you sense that at all?
Yes, I could, because I couldn't hear the tape edits, but I could hear the difference in the room sound.
Oh, my gosh, yeah, well, that's that's wonderful. I can hear the difference in my tonal quality. But, yeah, that's how we did that. And I have no recollection of, and neither did Ed have any recollection of how that interview was done, if you can imagine.
Really?
What we had decided is that it was recorded at the Voice of America by Ed in a studio. And that's all that I can imagine.
Did you do that on more than one occasion? Because it seemed to me that in a few instances, you asked questions, but you weren't there live in the studio with a guest.
All of the Los
Angeles. Yes, the answer to that is yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like in the Los Angeles-based interviews, when he would go to Hollywood or something, you would ask questions that he might have asked so that you would be included in the show?
Yes, in all probability, that's exactly what happened. And the show was built around the two of us.
Sure.
And we felt a little uncomfortable from it wasn't ego. It was a little uncomfortable from the standpoint of my being a personality at WTIC and not being on the program.
Mm-hmm.
So when Ed would do an interview, so I would insert my voice in those interviews. However, on the Edgar Bergen and Mel Blanc interviews, I did not do that because I felt that to do so would damage the interview. So.
Good for you.
We decided to run it, yeah.
Many people don't even think about that, and the results are obvious when they try and do something like that. So, yeah, and those were excellent interviews.
Dick, did you yourself collect any of the shows, having had that experience of doing some of the interviews?
You know, this would probably deflate your balloon, but I really don't have any interest in collecting the old shows. I enjoy listening to them. And, you know, we have Ed Walker's program here in Washington on Sunday nights, and I do. I tune in Gunsmoke and Dragnet, but I have no interest in collecting the old shows. I do collect old records, and when I say that, I mean records that go back to the turn of the 20th century, and I have an extensive collection of those, but not radio shows, no. Another point that I'd like to make is that when Ed and I started these programs, our listeners were, you know, in their 30s. I mean, they recognized the programs as having been part of their childhood, but they were not, you know, in any way, shape, or form middle-aged people. It was a young audience that we were appealing to. And today, you know, you think, well, gosh, you know, well, why would you put on a program for old people? They weren't old to begin with.
Those programs were done in 1970, 71 through 77. That's 40 years ago. And the further we get from the olden golden age of radio, the fewer people who are going to actually remember what it was like live. So it's even more important that these programs survive so that people, even 30 years from now, will have a chance to hear what it was like.
The window also narrows if you begin to think about it. For example, I've had a television set, or my family had a television set, since 1948. So that's 62 years of television. By stretching the point, we can say that radio existed for 30 years, but that really is stretching it. I think it was probably more like 25, golden age type radio. Yeah, because if you stop and say, well, you know, it started in the late 1920s, well, you know, by 1952, 53, radio was beginning to, you know,
fall
by the wayside. Mm-hmm. The shows were sustaining and so forth, you know.
Yeah, more and more money was being put into television, and so radio was allowed to die.
Well, and now television is fading a little bit because you've got the internet and so many different ways of accessing the information. But at least so far, the two tend to still exist together.
One other thing about radio that we haven't discussed is the medium itself, as far as its dramatic capabilities are concerned, I beg your pardon. When you listen to a radio drama, such as, let's say, Gunsmoke, you are actually in the set. You're riding that horse. You're walking through that door. You're going up the steps and so forth. Whereas with television, you watch it. It's what they say. It's a cold medium. And so it's an entirely different experience.
And I think that's why I got so much enjoyment out of radio. And I didn't listen to radio really when it was alive. the first time. I heard it when it was syndicated in the early 60s, but I still could get the same feeling as those who listened live just because of the things you mentioned. It was so easy to just jump inside and let your imagination work for you. With television, that's not possible.
That's right. So I think radio drama, radio programming as we knew it, has been shortchanged. It was more than simply the audio of television. Mm-hmm. It was a medium and a format unto its own.
Well, we want to thank both of you guys for being with us again and sharing memories, etc., because it gives us kind of an idea as to what it was like back in the early 70s, especially with regard to interviewing. And the show came across as a labor of love as well. Certainly you were doing what you could to fill an hour, but it came across as much more than that. And we thank you for the shows, and we thank you for your memories, and we thank you for being with us today.
Well, it's been my pleasure, and I hope we can be with you again sometime and talk more about old-time radio.
Excellent.
We hope you enjoyed the interview with Dick Pertell and Bob Schirago from WTIC, and we really do encourage you to go back up there and take a look at the website when you have an opportunity.
www.goldenage-wtic.org.